Helicaster Jane Show airs Wednesdays, 3 p.m. Eastern. The podcast always available online at HelicasterJane.com.
So I was thinking about what elections are really about. And lately, it seems every election, right? We say, this is the most important election ever. Is this right. The most important election ever?
No, but it's, but, you know, I'd say 1940 about whether we were going to get into World War II or not. That was probably a big deal. Or help Britain. Or, you know, there have been bigger ones, I think. But it's pretty big. You got a lot of Supreme Court seats open. So it's, you know, I think for a number of reasons, it is important. Above average important. Maybe not the most important.
Elections. Always important. And always thrilling. And there hasn't been one quite like election 2016, as they say in the vernacular, ever. Hillary, Trump, Cruz, Sanders, what a cast of characters. And we'll be talking about all of them, and art, history, freedom, and more, with my guests on the Helicaster Jane Show, when joining me at my table is cultural historian Dr. Victoria Coates, senior advisor for foreign policy on Senator Cruz's presidential campaign, and the author of David's Sling, A History of Democracy in 10 Works of Art. And in the second half hour, Newsweek magazine's political editor, Matthew Cooper. Hi, and welcome. Thank you so much for being here. I am your host, Helicaster Jane. But before we begin, today, the Helicaster Jane Show is brought to you by Audible.com, a leading provider of spoken audio information and entertainment. Get a free audiobook and 30-day trial today by visiting my website at HelicasterJane.com and clicking on the Audible.com icon for your free book. Hey, what's more fun than a free book? And remember, the Helicaster Jane Show is always available online at HelicasterJane.com and a host of venues, including Stitcher.com, Spreaker.com, TuneIn Radio, iTunes, iHeartRadio, and at our home network, Blog Talk Radio. Dr. Victoria Coates is a cultural historian who received her PhD from the University of Pennsylvania. She has served as a consulting curator at the Cleveland Museum of Art and as director of research in the office of Donald Rumsfeld. Currently, she is a senior staff member for national security for the United States Senate and the senior advisor for foreign policy on Senator Cruz's 2016 presidential campaign. But weeks before the historic caucuses, Iowa frontrunner Ted Cruz's foreign policy advisor comes to the Helicaster Jane Show to talk about Ted Cruz, but primarily to talk about Michelangelo and Monet. From politics to art, not the giant leap one might think, as she discusses in her wonderful new book, David's Sling, A History of Democracy in 10 Works of Art, in which she explores the remarkable synergy between freedom and the highest level of human achievement, and demonstrates how Western values are crucial to the expansion of liberty in our time. Let's talk.
So, Victoria, Dr. Coates, I love the premise of this book. Talk to me before we go into it in depth, what you were trying to say. What were you getting at here?
Well, Helen, thank you very much for having me on, and I appreciate your interest in David Sling. The premise of David Sling is really twofold. On the one hand, my purpose was to trace the history of democracy back to the ancient Athenians by doing an almost generational survey of the different free systems that have existed over the last 2,400 years. And at the same time, I wanted to propose a little bit of a different type of history from the kind of textbook-like tomes that have been produced on democracy in the past, and instead use 10 great works of art that were all self-consciously created to commemorate those free systems to illustrate them. So rather than just getting straight history, you are learning the story of one of the great works of the Western tradition, and through that story, getting the history of the democracy that created it.
It's a really different take on a lot of these wonderful pieces of art and architecture that you explore. But before we even get into the weeds of that, there's one other thing I want to talk to you about. My audience know that I rail, are you listening? I rail against everybody cutting liberal arts and art education, particularly in the lower schools. I want to hear what you have to say about that.
Oh, I think that is a good thing to rail against. And it's been very disappointing to me to hear a lot of politicians on both sides of the aisle bash art history, philosophy, the liberal arts, and say that they're useless, that they have no purpose and no value. And I think it's very important for us to remember we are, whether we like it or not, engaged in a struggle for civilization at the moment, for Western civilization. And if we don't define it as something that is worth protection and very much a celebration, then we're in danger of losing it. So I think it is very important that we have engineers and scientists and mathematicians. And I think it is also very important that they are aware of this tremendous legacy that it's our obligation and honor to protect.
Absolutely. And if we take that out just a little bit further, let's talk freedom. And one would think that man's innate proclivity would be the pursuit of liberty. And maybe it is. But that cry for freedom is often dwarfed by despots and power to inhibit the liberty of the many. And in the context of what we're about to talk to in the art and in moving democracy through these beautiful pieces that you point out in this terrific book, David Sling. Well, talk to me about that just a little bit before we go further.
Well, it was very much an instructive journey for me to explore how freedom both developed on that enormous rock in Athens. It was an extraordinary moment around 500 BC when the Athenians said, you know what, we can do this ourselves. And it was not a huge success. It had a century and a half in which some rather extraordinary things happened, and then it collapsed. So when you read that story, you learn at the beginning of the book that freedom is not inevitable, nor is it universal. It is a very difficult thing to achieve. And the book actually concludes with de Tocqueville and his visit to America and his reflections on freedom, which are very much along those lines, that it is the most precious thing. It is the most difficult thing to achieve. And then what's even harder, I suppose you can't be harder than the most difficult thing, but an even more difficult task is to preserve it over a period of time, because people tend to begin to take it for granted, become somewhat lazy in its defense. And I think that's really the kind of moment that we're facing now.
Couldn't agree with you more. I'm not sure that people understand that some of the art and architecture that you address in David Sling was actually commissioned work to send a message. Talk to me.
Yes, actually all 10
right.
were specifically commissioned. The only exception, I guess you'd say, would be Monet, because the Monet water lilies in Chapter 9 were done on the artist's own initiative, but then Monet decides to give them to his dear friend, the Prime Minister Georges Clemenceau, as a gift at the end of World War I to celebrate the fact that the terrible conflict was over and the Third Republic had been preserved. So that wasn't technically a commission, but all the others, it was a very deliberate act on the part of the artist, and all the others were very physically commissioned by governments to commemorate themselves.
It's 310 pages of riveting stories, by the way, and they are. They're wonderful. You're a writer.
Well, thank you.
It's true. Art historian, and you tell a great story. But it's talking about like the Parthenon and Michelangelo and Monet's, as you said, the water lilies. Let's go into the example of the Parthenon. Talk to us a little bit and give us a little bit of that background of that.
The Parthenon is such a fascinating object, and particularly in its current 21st century state. It's basically a ruin, originally constructed to be the grandest, the largest of the ancient Greek temples, the beautiful white marble temples with the columns around them that I'm sure your listeners are familiar with. And it had an extraordinary collection of sculpture on it, inside and out. And the sculptor who oversaw it is a man named Phidias, and then the great Athenian statesman Pericles was the one who commissioned it. And the very self-conscious premise of the Parthenon was that this most beautiful and most perfect of buildings with a suitable ornament for Athens, which was the first city in Greece because it was a democracy. And the nice thing is that Pericles got up and gave a big speech on precisely this topic right in front of the monuments he had constructed on the Acropolis. And the Greeks were so fascinated with themselves, they invented history writing, and the great historian Thucydides wrote the speech down. So we actually have the speech. And when you read chapter one, you read Pericles' words as he proclaims the primacy of Athens because of the freedom of Athens. And so following the example of Pericles, the Parthenon really becomes the paradigmatic object for democracy, So much so that when you get to chapter 8, which is the chapter on Great Britain, we see Lord Elgin in the very early 19th century going to Athens and actually removing a great deal of Phidias's sculpture and bringing it back to London to celebrate the constitutional monarchy that had been developed in Great Britain on the premise that London was the new Athens on the Thames, that this sculpture belonged in London because London was basically the child of Athens. And so the Parthenon really hangs over the whole book and is the only object that winds up getting two chapters.
How did you pick which ones you were going to use?
Well, it started with Michelangelo's David. I have a very dear friend who's a wonderful Michelangelo scholar, and she was working on some of his slaves who actually show up in the French Revolution chapter. They make a cameo. And she had discovered in the course of her research that the slaves had been offered as a diplomatic gift right at the time of the fall of the Florentine Republic in an attempt to get Francis I, the French king, to intervene on the part of the Republic. And it was a fascinating project, and it just got me thinking about the political activities and the political roles these very important objects have played. And that led to thinking about the David, which most people consider to be a Medici object. Everyone understands that it's a sort of an ideal of beauty, and if you take it a step further, they generally think of it in terms of the imperial family of Florence because it stood outside their home for many, many years. But originally, it was very deliberately carved while the Medici were in exile by the restored Florentine Republic, and Michelangelo was a committed Republican with a small r in this case, deeply, deeply patriotic and passionate about Florence and the city's freedom. And he really saw the statue as a warrior for the city, and that he was, by carving it, participating in the political life of his city. He actually wrote on a drawing, and this is sort of when it all came together in my mind when I was looking at this. He wrote, "As David did with his sling, so I do with my bow or my drill." So he was equating his act in carving to the biblical shepherd's act in killing the giant that was menacing the Israelites.
Your favorite? Did you have a favorite?
This is a very hard question. elements of each chapter wound up being my favorite. I'm trained in the Italian Renaissance, and so for me it was really a learning experience, for example, to work on the American chapter, the great Rocky Mountains landscape by Albert Bierstadt, which is a painting done in tribute to a general who died in the Civil War, but who had been a great explorer of the American West. And that chapter has many of my favorite elements in it. But I think if you really put the front thumb screws on me, I would have to say Michelangelo's David. It's pretty good.
To say the least, to say the least. Listen to me, this old line, Victoria, those who do not learn history are doomed to repeat it, or there are variations of the theme of that line. We can't have this conversation and not talk about that line.
Well, I think one of the most powerful lessons of the book, in very much in terms of both the wonderful aspirational and inspirational qualities of democracy, and certainly these 10 systems that produced these works really had no business doing anything grand. I mean, you think about Athens as a rock, Rome is a swamp, you know, the United States is a howling wilderness, Venice shouldn't even exist. And the only country that had any pretensions to sort of a long culture or an educated population would be France, and they collapsed in abject failure in a couple of years and have taken four tries to get it right. So it's very much that I find very inspiring to think of these little tiny states or very underdeveloped states that can punch so far above their weight. And that part of it is very, very hopeful. But at the same time, whenever you add human beings into any project like this, there's going to be error and failure. And one of my colleagues called the Rome chapter like reading Game of Thrones. He said, "Is someone else's head going to get chopped off? What's going on?" And so you also have some cautionary tale there, that to get back to what we were talking about earlier with de Tocqueville, that you have a very, very hard task both to institutionalize democracy and then to preserve it.
I'm going to ask you a question. I'm going to ask it of Dr. Victoria Coates, the art historian, and of Senator Ted Cruz's top foreign policy advisor. Okay? I'm wondering if the answer is going to be the same. Do we as a free people have a responsibility to forward democracy worldwide, or is to assume that we can impose democracy on other societies a foolhardy notion?
I don't think it's a binary choice. I think that we have wrapped ourselves into a situation where we're given the options by our policymakers that either you must impose democracy as a policy absolute. That is your goal, is the imposition of democracy, and that trumps everything else. Or you are the enemy of liberty and you have no interest in democracy and you are simply going to do what is most expedient. And I think that misses the real choice, which is we have in the United States the exceptional nation. I mean, that's what American exceptionalism means. It means we are the greatest democracy in the history of the world. And sure, we have our faults, but this is a terrific country with so much to celebrate and so much to share with the world. And if you believe that to be true, then it's fairly easy to believe that what is good for the United States, which what preserves the strength and the liberty of the United States, will be the best way to lift other countries up with you. And with a series of presidents who have understood that clearly, we've seen the massive expansion of democracy across the globe. You think about 70 years ago, Israel didn't exist and Japan was a deadly enemy. Today, flourishing democracies that are some of our most important security and economic partners. So that's a very, 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 very hopeful example. But I think if we lose sight of that priority and instead prioritize the abstract of democracy promotion, we, however oxymoronic it may seem, risk undermining the very freedom that we are trying to promote.
Back to education. Your candidate, Senator Ted Cruz, has strongly come out in opposition to Common Core, and I want your thoughts on that. And what's your influence on that? You're so right about that. That's so true. That's such a... But let me take this out one step further. Our education system, I think, is failing our children. Worldwide, we're only considered mediocre in education. And I think that, by the way, that would be putting a positive spin on it. Talk to me.
Mm-hmm. Well, and I think that's a real truth. And my issue with Common Core is that the basic premise of it is that additional centralized government involvement in education is going to be a good thing. And you can then parse what the details may be, but the notion that the federal government is going to have an effective role in improving the situation seems to me to be disproved by the history of education in the United States. I mean, what we've seen is the more federal involvement, the worse it's gotten. And I'm particularly interested in higher education. I'm a college professor. And what I see going on college campuses right now just breaks my heart. And that a book like David Sling would be considered in many ways radical because its basic premise is that the tradition of Western civilization is great and good. It's a shocking thing to proclaim on campus these days, and it would probably get me protested for my intolerance. So I think these are related issues, and you know, certainly Senator Cruz is very passionate about education. He's most interested in issues of school choice, which is something he calls the great civil rights issue of our time, because if we can get better education that into the hands of the neediest children who right now are being the most badly failed, then I think we have a great opportunity to help ourselves as a society.
So true. Question I know you've pondered yourself. Can we reject the mm-hmm. pervasive relativism of contemporary academia and reassert values of culture and moral excellence? I feel what you just said, particularly on college campuses, that we may be losing that battle. Yikes, right?
Oh, yes. I think that the forces for relativism have declared victory, but my hope is that they've been a little premature, because I think the growing disconnect between the academic sort of elite and the people whose children they are teaching, or that they deign to teach for basically the cost of a house, the expense of a high-level college education has become so prohibitive, and what the students are being taught has become so bizarre that you just wonder if at some point somebody's going to say, you know what, this isn't worth it. You know, here, kid, here's $250,000, go start a business. And you can see that logic. And now the sad thing is that the kid, if he or she went to a school where they were taught something of value, you know, would start a better business. So, I mean, it's not that higher education has no role, but I feel like what is happening on campuses, and certainly the sort of celebrity episodes that we've seen this year with really bizarre behavior driven by extreme political correctness, I mean, radical political correctness, demonstrates that we're heading towards something of a tipping point.
I hope we don't have to go over to get back.
I hope so too.
Right? I mean, it's very frightening to me. We talked briefly about this, but I want to just take one step out, as noted as in the intro. And Victoria, you serve as senior staff member for national security for the United States Senate and for the senior advisor of foreign policy on Senator Cruz's presidential campaign. And after all we've talked about here, and we've touched on this a little bit, I want to take it out, as I said, a little further. I'd like to discuss American foreign policy for a minute. Would it be accurate to describe Senator Cruz's policy as advocating American exceptionalism without nation building? There's something new. But I also have to ask this. Can a foreign policy, listen to me, be static, be a one-size-fits-all? Does our national security depend on a certain fluidity and even a move away from the rigidity of political dogma that seems to have taken over this nation? And I ask that knowing that in the scheme of American history today, we are at a most dogmatic time. We're polarized.
I agree. And it's something that it's been rather surprising, the virulence of the reaction on both the left and the right to Senator Cruz proposing that maybe he's not a hawk, maybe he's not a dove. I've joked with him that maybe he's an owl.
That's a good bird.
It is the bird of Athena. So to propose that you can have a foreign policy that is very carefully principled, and certainly the idea of promoting American exceptionalism that we were talking about is a principle which can guide your decisions, but it doesn't mean you approach every situation exactly the same. You could look at Iran and say, you know what, regime change in Iran is a great idea. These guys are terrible. They've been chanting death to America for 36 years. They've killed hundreds of Americans. They've got Americans in prison. They're almost certainly pursuing a nuclear weapon. If not now, they will be. This is terrible. There really isn't a worse option for us than Iran. And you could say you also have there a very highly educated population. You have a very strong sense of cultural history, and you really have a good shot at setting up a more tolerant, inclusive, and less aggressive form of government. And then you could contrast that with Libya, you know, which is a made-up state governed by a rotten dictator who had killed also a number of Americans in the skies of Scotland and generally been a major problem, but who had been persuaded by strong congressional legislation to give up his nuclear program, and who at that point was even cooperating with the United States because he knew, and I know certain levels of our government knew, that this invented state of Libya had within it a terrible radical terrorism problem. And that at that point, when you look at that and you think, gee, I'd really like there not to be a dictator in Tripoli, but I think we've got a worse option here.
Right.
You might be a little bit more cautious about that.
Right. Holding down the fort is what he was good for, we've learned, right?
Unfortunately, yes.
Right. So listen to me. Lots of concepts rolling together here. Art, education, democracy, freedom, politics. At the end of this terrific book, and everybody really picked this up, it is great, David Sling, A History of Democracy in 10 Works of Art, you pose a series of questions. Will liberty always be a rare thing in history rather than a trend of history? And will liberty, where it does prevail, continue to nurture the kind of cultural excellence for which the Athenians set an enduring standard? But you don't answer them. I want the answer.
Well, sadly, my crystal ball is cracked. So this week, when it comes back, I can answer.
Well, then you'll have to come back and tell me. But yeah.
Well, I think the book actually does answer the question that, I mean, certainly time and time again, it has seemed like liberty was extinguished and that there was just no way for it to come back. And if you look at the twin existential threats of the 20th century, you look at fascism and totalitarian communism, both of which weren't just efforts against one free state. It's not like the Medici coming to claim Florence. The Medici weren't trying to extinguish democracy around the world. The fascists and the Soviets were. They actually wanted to get rid of the concept altogether. And boy, did times look dark in both of those both World War II and the Cold War. But we made it through. And now one cautionary note is at the end of the Cold War, you had a lot of people declaring that history was over, that the trend toward democracy was inevitable. And yet here we are in our own time seeing the supremacist Islamism that is also targeting on both the Sunni and the Shiite side is trying to extinguish the kinds of liberties that we hold most dear. And it hasn't gotten itself perhaps organized quite to the point of being the Germans or the Soviets. But if we don't think that it's trying to, I think we're fooling ourselves. And so I think the challenge of the book there at the end is to see, you know, which would be the next hand to reach out and grab David Sling.
One last question. It's my Barbara Walters question. Got to ask one of those, right? So in one word, darling, what is Ted Cruz really like?
I've got one word?
Well, no, you can take as many as you like.
He's a human, to start out, which you lose a lot of in the press coverage of him. And he is a very, like my old boss, Don Rumsfeld, he is a politician who improves with knowing his humanity. That with a lot of folks, you get to know them, you see behind the curtain, and you're disappointed in what you see. I found with Senator Cruz that his humanity, I mean, he does have the occasional fault. He would debate me on that, but it's true. I stand by that statement. But his faults make his successes all the more impressive. You realize that here is somebody who wakes up every morning and, you know, thinks first of his beautiful wife and lovely children, and then thinks about our country and what can he do to protect the country, to make it safer, to make it more prosperous. And that really is what directs his actions. And as I said, nobody's perfect. He can occasionally be sometimes less than perfect. But that basic premise is real, and it really is impressive, and it gives you great confidence in what he would do as president.
I've been speaking with Dr. Victoria Coates, the author of David's Sling, A History of Democracy in 10 Works of Art by Way of Encounter Books, and available in fine bookstores everywhere. Journalist and veteran White House correspondent Matthew Cooper is known for his in-depth reporting and analysis from Washington. Mr. Cooper has worked for some of America's most prestigious magazines, including Time, The New Republic, National Journal, and U.S. News and World Report. He wrote for Newsweek in the 1990s and rejoined the relaunched magazine in 2014 as political editor. Cooper also earned national attention during the CIA leak case when he was held in contempt of court and threatened with imprisonment for his refusal to name his sources and to testify before the grand jury regarding the Valerie Plame CIA leak investigation, a case that went all the way to the Supreme Court. He has appeared on 60 Minutes, Meet the Press, Hardball, The O'Reilly Factor, and This Week with George Stephanopoulos. Let's talk. So, Matt, we're already halfway through the January. God, how did that happen? And the caucus is coming just around the corner. And Trump and Cruz are neck and neck in the polls. So, oh, wise one, you're going to hate me for starting like this, but I have to. Could you have ever predicted this? And what is the real prediction here? Look into your crystal ball, oh, wise one, Cruz or Trump?
Well, predictive. Look, Trump's been in the lead pretty much since he announced. So in a way, it was predictable. It's just the establishment thinking for months has been that, you know, Trump had to fade, that it was an infatuation and not a romance with the Republican Party. But it continues. So in a way, it was predictable. Cruz in second place? Well, you know, there's a certain logic to it, right? I mean, the same frustrations that are fueling Trump are fueling him as well. And, you know, it says something. As to who wins, I don't know. Iowa's notoriously hard to predict. The caucus system's very funky that way. And, you know, we'll just have to see.
Let's talk a little bit about Ted Cruz. Give me your take on this guy. I mean, whatever the meaning of mainstream is at this point, right? That's kind of weird in and of itself. So in our assessment of the GOP, where does he fit on that spectrum such as it is in this year, this crazy year?
Well, I think It's not so much, I think if you talk to people on Capitol Hill, it's not so much that his views are wildly different than other conservatives. It is just that he was not what might be called a governing conservative. You know, there is a majority still of Republicans in Congress who are very conservative, but at the end of the day, they're going to vote for, you know, a budget that raises, you know, that funds Planned Parenthood or does something they don't like. And Cruz was part of the Tea Party wave that said, no, if it doesn't have these things, I'm not going to vote for it, and I'm willing to hold up the entire government until I'm defeated. And Cruz was a belief in that. So it was more a style than an ideology, I think.
I think that's the point that I want to get to. We're going to really explore that in a second. But I want to ask you this. Bright guy, smart guy. And I, when I say that, I don't just mean, you know, right now we're talking two things here. We're talking bright intellect, but we're also talking bright political. I want to just talk about the intellect. What's your take?
Well, I think by all accounts, the intellect is formidable, or at least in terms of kind of, you know, mental agility. I mean, there's the obvious credentials he has, right? He went to Princeton, he got to Harvard Law School, he did well. He certainly has all that. But if you look at things like his Supreme Court arguments, he's very good, even among Supreme Court litigators who are an elite group themselves. He's just a very good, he was championship debater in college, and he has the kind of mental alacrity that allows for. Now, you know, is that the same as being a deep intellectual? Probably not, but, you know, I'm not sure that's necessarily the best quality in a president too. So I think kind of the intellect is, you know, is there in a way that is akin to other presidents we've had. We've had a lot of Harvard and Yale presidents and presidential candidates in recent years, and I think he's in that vein. Politically, I think you have to say he's pretty smart, right? He was only elected in 2012, so, okay, he's been in Congress just 3 years, and look at the name he's made for himself. Now, granted, he's not really very well liked by Republicans or Democrats in the Senate. He doesn't pass laws. I mean, by a lot of traditional metrics, he's not a success, but by the success of national renown and a plausible shot at his party's presidential nomination, he's doing very well.
Did I hear you say you don't have to be all that smart to be president of the United States?
No, I was just saying you don't have to be I was just saying his kind of smarts, a kind of mental agility and you know, a good in school ability is not necessarily the same as being a deep intellect. But being a deep intellect is probably not necessarily a great quality for a president.
Maybe that's what we should explore. But
I mean, the intellectuals who have been president, you know, have run for president, been president, Woodrow Wilson. You know, it's not necessarily the best recommendation.
I'll let you off the hook on that one. Let me take you here. I understand Cruz has got a heck of a ground game going on in Iowa, and he seems ideologically suited to be natural, the one that for the caucus goers, if it was a normal year, more than a Trump year, but this isn't a normal year. So I'm curious about that, why that is. What's going on in America that is fueling this abnormality? Is it Trump who fueled it, or is it things that are going on in the country, or a reaction to Obama?
Well, I think you got a whole bunch of different things going on. I mean, starting in Iowa, where the caucuses have always, in recent decades, been dominated by evangelicals. So, you know, in 1988, Bob Dole won the Iowa caucuses. Pat Robertson came in second, and the vice president of the United States, George H.W. Bush, came in third. You know, Rick Santorum won last year. Mike Huckabee won the previous cycle. So, you know, it's if you do well with religious conservatives, you've got a shot at winning the Republican Iowa caucuses. And Cruz has worked them very well. And I think he's more comfortable in that milieu as a Texas politician than is Donald Trump, who is, you know, at the end of the day, is, let's say, libertine in his background. And so, you know, I think Cruz has an advantage there. And then, you know, in a larger sense, Cruz is fitting in with a lot of Republicans who are not only angry at Obama, but are very angry at their own party, thinks they haven't fought enough, thinks they haven't been contentious enough with Obama. And, you know, he's captured that as Trump.
Are you surprised that Trump is doing as well as he is?
Well,
there?
I think you and I had talked about before. I always thought Trump had a good niche because there was a room for a tough on trade Republican, and there was a lot of room for a protect entitlements Republican, which is the opposite of where most of them are at. I didn't foresee the strength of the immigration argument, and that I think has driven Trump more than anything. And Cruz has, adroitly, managed to flip over to that. He was a kind of moderate supporter of immigration reform when he first got to the Senate. Now he's taken a very Trump line on immigration.
Let's go back to Iowa for a second. Does it matter? They haven't been picking the right horse in a long time, right?
Right. They don't pick the right horse, but they thin the herd. It's really less who wins and more who comes in, let's say, lower than fourth. I mean, it has a tendency to just kind of weed out a number of people. And that's probably its greatest effect.
And it's so Americana.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, nobody wants to let go.
And, you know, look, it became famous because of Jimmy Carter. It catapulted him from obscurity. But since then, it's picked, such... winners as President Edwards, President Dole, President Santorum.
Yeah, it hasn't happened, right?
President Paul Simon.
Oh,
it's had a lot of people lose Iowa. I mean, win Iowa and then lose quickly.
Right. I want to go back to temperament for a second. You brought it up. Let's talk about it. Among the establishment, he isn't well-liked. And if that's true, shouldn't that work for him if he were smart rather than...
Well, yeah, I think it has. I mean, I think he's just... that's why he's in second. He's, and people who had commanded a lot of interest like Rubio or Bush and... or not. No, I think he's good at that. I think he's just kind of personally, and I haven't spent much time with him, so I base this on what I know, what I hear from people. He's just kind of personally abrasive. When he first got to Washington, he got a Supreme Court clerkship, and he was, you get a Harvard Law School graduate, Supreme Court clerk, Hispanic. I mean, he should have been, by all accounts, headed towards a great White House job. And some of the Bush campaign people found him so annoying that he was relegated to the Federal Trade Commission.
Not personable.
He's just not super personable. Although I say when he speaks, he has a certain twinkle.
Interesting. This is so interesting to me in this respect, that if you elect a guy like that, who we already know does not get along with Congress, imagine him sitting in the Oval Office. That would concern me if I were a voter. What would happen if he got into office? I mean, he's really taken it on the chin from a lot of people. I mean, David Brooks today called him his brand of evangelicalism brutalism in the New York Times. And McCain and McConnell have told him, you're on your own with this birther thing, which we'll talk about in a sec. Jeez.
Yeah, well, he's trying to picture President Cruz is difficult because we haven't had anyone who is that kind of, we haven't had an obstructionist become president, right? So Reagan was a pretty successful governor, as was Clinton and Carter to a lesser extent, and Bush. So we've had a lot of those. We haven't had someone who came out of the legislature all vinegar and spiky and then became vinegar. The president. So who knows what it would look like? I imagine he would just have to change his style.
Or dig in.
Or just, be content not to pass anything.
Right. I mean, it's an interesting question, I think. And I think a fair one. So I didn't hesitate to ask it.
Yeah.
Here's something else. So Trump goes after him on the issue of where he was born and if he's a naturalist.
Sure.
Okay. And, the old Bertha thing, kind of turning it around. And I don't think we have to explain that to the listeners. I'm pretty sure they got that when it's all out there. But what I want to say is he isn't one in the past to have rattled easily. He does appear to have been rattled by Trump's game with him. They started out as friends, quote unquote, if there's such a thing in politics, right?
Right.
We've learned that Trump doesn't have friends. He goes where he needs to go when he needs to go there, and he's ruthless. Did Cruz hurt himself by playing nice with the president, with Trump? With the president. Oh, my God. What did I say? With Donald Trump.
No, I don't think we totally know the answer to that yet. It's still playing out, but I think you could make a case that those who have attacked Trump as dangerous, as bigoted, as horrible for Republicans are not doing very well. Those who have had a lighter touch with Trump, you know, are doing better. So I'm not sure it's hurt him. You know, I do think the birther thing is, it seems to have gotten under his skin a bit. I think he had just assumed that this would be sort of not that big an issue. And it is. It's an issue.
It's an issue more because members of his own party are going after him hook, line, and sinker on this. McConnell says he's not going to rescue him, and McCain is having a field day with him as well. And, I mean, we can go on and on and on. It is kind of bizarre, don't you think?
Well, it is. I mean, I think the irony or hypocrisy is that Cruz prides himself as a strict constructionist who wants to read the Constitution in a very limited and originalist way. But when it comes to this question of presidential eligibility, he's suddenly kind of an expansive,
right,
Warren Court liberal. He's taking the broadest possible definition of natural born citizen.
Yeah. And I think it's also interesting that that's the first time I've heard anybody really say that. Good for you, Mr. Cooper. I think that is a point well made.
Yeah, it's just, yeah, I mean, you know, everybody's a hypocrite at some level, but this is,
but this is his,
I think. And look, you know, I mean, there are scholars, a lot of them, who say he's right, but there do seem to be others who say not. There's a big piece in the Washington Post today to that effect. And it probably, and look, if he's on his way to becoming the nominee, I think it's almost certain to go to court. And
For sure, to go to court.
Right. I don't see how it won't end up in the judiciary.
Yeah.
Someone's going to make it a point.
But the other side of that is, it's hard for me to understand if the Republican people, the establishment, I have a hard time using that word, but if that's for lack of a better one, the establishment are going after Cruz, they're bumping up Trump. Something in here we don't get?
Well, I think there's starting to be, some establishment types are getting resigned to the idea that
it could
either
be
Trump or Cruz can be the nominee, and they're trying to weigh what they see as the lesser of two evils. And some of them are thinking, well, you know, Trump, he's got a kind of popular wave, and maybe he'll be able to sweep some people into the party who have not been there before, and maybe he won't hurt the down ballot as much as Cruz might. And, you know, other people look at it differently. Yes, that's kind of where we're at on that establishment question.
Some more on this interesting cycle. I don't think anyone truly understands what's going on here. Certainly no one comprehends this Trump. I call it a fever. I think it is. That's infected so many. But I want to look at what some of the Republican establishment think is a virus and talk about what a presidential election is about, Matt. At the end of the day, isn't it about electing an American president who serves as the leader of the free world, the operative word here being leader?
Well, sure. I mean, it is a leader. It's, you know, we don't have a monarch or a honorary presidency like other countries. So, you know, this person is kind of the leader of the society as much as the government. And so, you know, people want somebody who, you know, they think shares their values. And, you know, it's going to be very hard to find much consensus on that. I think if the election is Hillary versus Trump or Hillary versus Cruz, the 50% of the country that's disappointed when their guy loses or their lady loses, they're going to be really, I think, embittered in a way that will make Bush Gore look like a party. Because I just think, you know, those Trump and Cruz supporters having to live with President Hillary and vice versa, I think it's the country's divided. I think it's going to be really divided after this election.
Well, we're going to hold.
I mean, I could be wrong. Maybe it'll be like, you know, a love fest between Kasich and Clinton, but I doubt it.
No, I don't think there's going to be a love fest out there. But I think what you just said is interesting, and let me put that on hold for a second because I want to take this leadership thing out with you a bit, because I want to say to you about this word leader and leadership, if you will. If that's what this is all about, I think you got to say that Trump is the person showing the most leadership skills here. Yikes! I can't believe I'm saying that, but I am. I mean, he's upended the Republican Party, the establishment. He's had an effect on the Democrats. Everybody is following following his lead, morphing the way they're campaigning. Everything is the way right. that Trump is in control. So if that is who he is, and he's the man running the show in that contest, can Groups, or anybody for that matter, grab the mantle or qualify for the mantle of the leader of the free world?
Well, you know, if they get more votes, they can. I mean, it's I agree to this point. Trump has set the agenda for everyone, and he's changed the race. I mean, Cruz is running as Trump light and not the other way around. So, yeah, I think you're right about him leader so far. But, you know, that'll change potentially when people start to vote. You know, we'll just have to see.
You know, I read a piece that Cruz is testing some attacks on Trump. You know, the usual suspects, right. You know, abortion, Trump and religion.
Right.
New York
I don't lib. Think the I don't think the Trump is not a true conservative line has worked so far.
No, I agree.
I think people have sort of accepted that and they don't care. I mean, really super conservative. A number of super conservatives have accepted that and don't seem to care.
So let me talk to you about Trump in this respect, okay? Let me talk to you about Trump in the respect of, remember that old Teflon president we once had?
Right.
I think we got a Teflon candidate.
Right. Right. Or he's like, well, I'm trying to think of some other metaphor.
Okay, go ahead. I can give you all the
time. I don't know. I mean, it's just you throw things at him and he's, yeah, I mean, I guess it's Teflon. Nothing really sticks.
Nothing sticks, and it's because he's got...
Or just every insult that's hurled at him is one that people have taken into account already, you know, right? Is he an egomaniac? Sure. Was he once more liberal? Sure. I mean, I just think people have... None of these attacks really add new information to what voters know already about Trump.
Okay, and I agree with that, but I think there's something else that's going on here, and I think that that's how he built his campaign. It's like rope-a-dope. I mean, he can go from one corner to the next and just bounce around, bounce off that rope, because he set it up that you can't really get at him, because that's how he set it up. He saw his vulnerabilities, and he's almost put it out there, like, you know, in other words, you know, come clean. I'm a liar. Okay, what are you going to do? I just told you I was a liar. You can't touch me because I already told you I was a liar. I mean, is there some of that actually going on here?
Yeah, some of that. I just think none of them have really found the crack.
Well, I don't know that it's
crack,
there.
And I don't know if it's out there.
Yeah, I don't know if it's there either. Interesting, right?
Yeah.
Which makes every other candidate who's going to go up against him, including Cruz, vulnerable because they didn't build their campaigns the way that Trump did.
Right.
So, you know, if you're going on that concept, we're in interesting times, to say the least. All right, I'm going to save you.
I think we are.
All right, I'm going to save you. Let's talk Hillary for a minute. She's the only one who seems not to be following or falling for Trump's lead, so to speak. She's just not engaging. That's a problem, too, because that leaves you vulnerable by not doing anything. It's almost like she's saying, if I do respond, I lose my leadership quality. How's Hillary doing in your eyes?
Oh, I think she's going to have a rough few weeks here. I think, you know, she'll probably pretty good chance she could lose Iowa and New Hampshire. She may not, but I think it's going to be close at best. And she's going to have to, you know, fight her way to this nomination. I think the calendar will come. I think she looks very strong in South Carolina, looks very strong in Nevada. And then you go into southern states where she looks very strong. And I think she'll get through this, but this is going to be a difficult period for her. But, you know, it helps to have done this before. You know, most nominees are people who have run before, and it helps. Not all of them, but most are. And she's steady. She's very steady. And I think, as with Trump, people have kind of made their decisions about whether she's trustworthy or not, or whether she's tired in the past or not. People have kind of, like, you know, people have formed their opinions about Trump and Hillary already.
Okay.
I don't think there's a lot of new information.
So knowing that, you know, what the great right would be, becomes the comeback kid.
Right.
Wouldn't that just be ironic?
Right. Well, I think you could have a little bit of that. I think she's going to fight her way. I think she's going to take some hits. I think these first two contests are really good terrain for Sanders. As you know, Hillary came in third in the Iowa caucuses in 2008. It's Bill Clinton. They didn't really compete in Iowa in 1992 because Tom Harkin was the senator from there. And then 1996, he was president and unopposed. So the Clintons don't have a huge track record in Iowa, and I think, you know, this will be her chance to get a ride. The problem is, I think it's pretty well set up for Sanders. Clinton does better with minority voters, much better. That's her key to being the nominee. And there aren't tons of them in Iowa. There are tons of them in New Hampshire.
Right, right. Agreed.
And that's tough.
It's interesting that you say that. There's another little thing that's going on here, and I was dying to ask you this question, and that is, it seems to me that after that little brouhaha with the DNC and Sanders, and the roster, and what have you, that, you know, all gloves are off. I'm getting the feeling that the left on the Democratic Party is really seeing blood towards Hillary.
Yeah, well, I think there are a lot of people in the Democratic Party who've never really cottoned to either Clinton. They see the 90s and they don't look back with fondness. They see it as, you know, the Defense of Marriage Act and Wall Street deregulation and free trade agreements. And they're not so happy with the 90s. And so they're not so happy with Hillary. And I think she's going to get some of that this time. And that's before you get to her Iraq war vote or other things. So, you know, she's got to carry that. On the other hand, you know, look, there are a lot of people who love her and love the Clintons as a whole. And, you know, that's, and especially among minority voters. So, you know, we'll see. I think she gets through this, but I think it's going to be a rough few weeks here.
Okay. On this Trump-Cruz deal and the Republican Party, I have to ask you this as well. I want to ask you about the fact that if Cruz were really to take Trump down, if you will, seriously take him down, there is this problem of the disaffected voters who have gone wholeheartedly, like I said, you know, that, you know, got this virus going in their systems. Does the Republican Party at some point have to say, now look, be careful here. We don't, if he's in fact bringing in these new voters, we can't afford to disenfranchise them, guys.
Right.
Rubio, you know, Cruz, whomever. That's an issue.
Well, sure. I think it's easier for Cruz in a sense because he's not running on big ideological disagreements with Trump. So I think he's poised to keep those people in the party if he became the nominee. I think it would be much tougher for, you know, somehow one of the Christie or Kasichs or one of them somehow became a leading contender. Then I think a lot of those people would throw up their hands and walk out of the party. Those people who had been brought in by Trump.
All right, I got two. One is a real quick one, but this is an interesting concept I wanted to throw out at you. A Trump-Cruz ticket. You could say that that would be the left and the right coming together in a sense, because we all know that Trump actually is not nearly as nuts as he's making himself out to be as he's running in the primaries and blah, 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 blah. That could really be a threat to Hillary, couldn't it? Those two together?
Well, we don't, I'm not dodging it, but we just don't know. I mean, you know, I could see it going either way, right? It really just turns off a lot of people. It just seems too bellicose, too nationalist, too a little out there. You know, on the other hand, it's got a certain kind of populist feel and it's certainly change. You know, right?
Oh.
It's definitely a vote for change more than voting for, you know, Barack Obama's Secretary of State. It's certainly a change vote.
Fascinating.
So, you know, I could see it going either way.
So here's my last question for today, or she'll be back as we go through this crazy cycle. But before we close, I was thinking about what elections are really about. And lately, it seems every election, right, we say, this is the most important election ever. Is this
right.
The most important election ever?
No, but you know, I'd say 1940 about whether we were going to get into World War II or not. That was probably a big deal. Or help Britain, or, you know, there have been bigger ones, I think, but it's pretty big. You got a lot of Supreme Court seats open. So it's, you know, I think for a number of reasons, it is important. Above average important, maybe not the most important.
I've been speaking with Matthew Cooper, political editor for Newsweek magazine. For his insightful reporting, visit newsweek.com or visit him on Facebook at Matthew Cooper, and on Twitter, his handle is Matty Scoop. Before I go, I want to remind everyone that podcasts of Current and Past shows are always available to listen to free on iTunes under The Hallie Kasser-Jane Show. The Hallie Kasser-Jane Show is also available for download via Spreaker.com, Stitcher.com, BlogTalkRadio.com, and a host of other venues. Google The Hallie Kasser-Jane Show and you will find us. Of course, podcasts of our shows, both past and present, are always posted for your listening pleasure at HallieKasserJane.com. HallieKnoll.com. I'll be back next week, same time, 3 p.m. Eastern, for another edition of the Hallie Kasser-Jane Show, brought to you by Audible.com. Get a free audiobook download at www.audibletrial.com/The Hallie Kasser-Jane Show. Stay in touch, won't you? Remember, that's HallieKasserJane.com. Discover us on Facebook at Hallie Kasser-Jane and on Twitter at HallieCJ. I love to hear from you. So, till we meet again, this is Hallie Kasser-Jane. It's a wrap.